The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. It's just approaching 4 minutes past nine on this Wednesday, the 25th of March, 2026. And you're very welcome along to The Greg Hughes Show. We're with you until 11 a.m. and we've got an awful lot to pack in between now and then. We want your views and your contributions throughout the course of the morning. As always, though, 086 6025000, WhatsApps and texts that number. Give us a call either on 07491 25000, or if you prefer, you can email comments at highlandradio.com. And just a reminder for you that you can watch this show every single day, and it's very easy to do so. Even if you're at home, most of you now have a smart TV or your Fire Stick. All you need is the YouTube app and type in Highland Radio Ireland, and we are there streaming live. And you can watch the show and the majority of our guests live on your big screen TV. YouTube, of course, good for your mobile devices. And also, we are cross Facebook and on the X platform as well. So no excuse. And no excuse not to get involved and chat to us. So you can comment on the socials as well, if you prefer to do that. Let's have a look at what's making some of the front and inside the newspapers today. And we'll start with the Finn Valley Voice, which is out today. Pat Holland writes that a proposed merger linking Arrivo, the milk cooperative giant that includes the former Donegal creameries at Killigordon, to Northern Ireland's Dale Farm has fallen through. Following detailed talks over recent months, they had decided that now is not the right time to proceed with the merger process. Instead, the two boards have agreed to work together on projects, including byproduct utilisation and added value protein, says Arrivo CEO Mr. Donal Tierney. On to the Nationals now, and of course you've heard it on the news all morning, and there was plenty of talk about it yesterday, the day before, and that is a tax reduction on petrol and diesel. And as we said in the show yesterday, it's very likely that your local forecourt is selling petrol and diesel that they bought at the higher rate. So they have to exhaust those supplies before they restock and sell you the petrol and diesel at the lower rate. Fuel retailers were urged to ensure that tax cuts were quickly passed on to motorists, and householders were encouraged to conserve energy, as a €250 million package of cost of living supports was unveiled by the government. A series of temporary measures aimed at easing the impact of soaring energy costs were announced yesterday, with the opposition later attacking the supports, which they claimed did not go far enough. One of the things that's going to impact us quite a bit is no real help on home heating oil. And I was saying to Lee, like many others, you know, some people were lucky and ordered heating oil before the prices shot up. Most of us weren't. And it is very expensive. I think what is about $880 for 500 litres at the moment. The only saving grace is we are heading towards summer. But there was nothing really in it in these cost of living measures for a lot of us in this part of the world that rely on home heating oil. It's not as big a problem in the population centres. You know, they don't have oil tanks necessarily out the back of thousands of houses in Dublin, but we rely on it quite a lot here, and there was just nothing there really, or not much there really, to help us. The cost of fuel at the pump soared to over €2 per litre in the wake of the attack by the United States and Israel and Iran. The fuel industry denied price gouging immediately after the outbreak of the war. At a press conference yesterday, Taoiseach Micheál Martin and Tánaiste Simon Harris both set out their expectations that cuts and excises on petrol and diesel will be passed on to consumers. But the only problem is that, you know, it's 225, 230, 229, 228, 222 a litre for diesel. I'll focus on that for a moment. And you take that 20 cent off, which is better than nothing at all, of course, and it still leaves a litre of diesel at over €2, which is unbelievable, isn't it? So the sooner things are settled in the Middle East, of course, primarily for people living there and their literal lives, but also for the economy, the better, because this is not sustainable. And it affects different people in different ways. The Irish Independent tells us that thousands of nurses and midwives who care for patients in their own homes want higher mileage rates due to the fuel crisis. And when I was reading this as well, I was thinking on people who do home care. It's probably as relevant up here as anything. I wonder, are you a carer, and do you pay your own petrol and diesel? Maybe that's supplied by the company, I'm not sure. But I would imagine if you were getting a rebate for it, has that rebate gone up? So it might affect people in that area as well. If it does, let me know. But this story focuses on thousands of nurses and midwives who care for patients in their own homes. The leader of the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation has written to the HSE seeking the top rates of motor travel handling system until the end of the crisis. The letter was sent amid growing signs that other unions could follow suit and seek enhanced supports to ease fuel price pressures. Now, vacant properties. 70,000 vacant properties across Ireland. It's been described as a scandal. Over 70,000 homes are lying vacant despite the severe housing crisis, new analysis shows. The state has an estimated deficit of up to 256,000 homes, meaning the empty and unused homes would fill almost a third of the shortfall. Social Justice Ireland called it a severe long-term housing shortage, which it blamed on a chronic underinvestment and supply failing to meet rising demand. The crisis has resulted in record homelessness of 14,000 people and high rent costs. It is projected to persist for at least another 15 years, it added. But I had a look at the Donegal figures to see where we are at. And we have the second highest rate of vacant property. 6.2% of Donegal homes are lying vacant. Interestingly, 37% of that total are detached homes. So these are decent-sized homes as well. So it's about 5,603 homes in Donegal are lying vacant. Now, what would the first thing you would put that down to? You would say, oh, holiday homes, it's not a true figure. Well, that's not the case, actually, because the CSO employ a system to determine the vacant properties that eliminates holiday homes. So I just thought I'd clarify this, because often you hear, or I hear, not you, but I hear reports on radio or on TV, but it doesn't really explain what's going on. I can't give all the answers, but I can tell you that these are homes in Donegal that are not holiday homes, that are connected to the ESB, but lie empty. So to calculate these vacancy figures, the CSO gets rid of door-to-door surveys that they'd be known for and uses data from the ESB to track actual electricity usage. So a property is only classified as vacant if it uses a very low amount of electricity, less than 180 kilowatts per hour per quarter for four consecutive quarters. So that's a full 12-month period. So in other words, that property is not being let out as a short-term let, or it's not a holiday home. Because if it were, it would see a spike in electricity usage in certain months or at certain times, and therefore wouldn't be counted in these figures. So because of this strict 12-month timeline, the methodology effectively screens out your summer holiday homes or your short-term lets. So if a property is used for even a few weeks during the summer, the electricity burned by showers, kettles, lightings and TVs will push it well past the 180 kilowatt per hour limit for that quarter. So by failing the four consecutive quarters, it rules the holiday home. The holiday home is classified as occupied. So the 5,603 vacant homes flagged in Donegal are not summer retreats or holiday homes or short-term lets. They are properties that have been sitting completely unused, emptied or abandoned all year round. So that's a lot, isn't it? 5,603. And when you look at the 70,000 total, really there should be no massive shortage of homes in Donegal if we were using the stock correctly. Now, if someone owns a home and they want to have it lying empty for a year, that's up to them. You know, I mean, it's their own private property. There are parties that would prefer if that property was taken from them or they were taxed out of having it vacant. But it is where it is. So 5,603 vacant homes. There was one very small electoral area in the west of the county where it has a 21% vacancy rate. Now, it might only be 100 homes, but 21 of them are vacant if it is. So just thought I'd give you a bit of facts behind those details. Gardaí have arrested an employee of the company behind Ireland's biggest independent radio station after officers made a major drug seizure at its HQ. The man was arrested when Gardaí seized more than 100,000 euro of suspected cannabis at the Dublin offices of Bar Media Audio Ireland on Monday. Marconi House in central Dublin, where the seizure was made, is home to several of Bauer's radio stations, including News Talk and Today FM. Some 5.5 kilograms of suspected cannabis worth more than 100K was seized. Sources have confirmed to the paper that the suspect who was arrested following the seizure is not one of the company's journalists or editorial staff, but has a different role in the company. He was arrested after a joint operation by Gardaí and Customs involved in a so-called controlled delivery at the premises. Interesting. And finally, interesting comments from John Connors. He's a very well-known actor, of course, and a very proud member of the Traveller community. And he's issued an emotional appeal with tears quite literally in his eyes for an end to ongoing Traveller feuds following the vicious attack on a young mum Scarlett Faulkner. Connors, a well-known actor and writer from Dublin, rose to prominence for his role as Patrick Ward in the RTE crime drama Love Hate. As a proud Traveller, he's also been an outspoken advocate on issues affecting the community, frequently using his platform to highlight inequality, discrimination and violence. His comments come after Limerick mum Scarlett Faulkner, 29, was brutally beaten by a group armed with weapons at the side of the R494 in Birchill on Saturday evening. The motive for the assault, which saw her dragged from her vehicle after it was rammed, remains unclear. In a social media message, Connors admitted his own past involvement in feuding, describing himself as a walking, talking hypocrite who has been caught up in violence from a young age. "Lads, what are we doing? We're destroying our own community," he said. "I've been involved in feuds myself at 11 or 12 years of age with grown men coming after me in the streets." And he effectively said, move away from feuding and move back towards God. And I'm very pleased to welcome on to the programme John McAteer, editor of the Tyrconnell Tribune. Good morning, John. Great to see you.
Good morning. Good morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm good. And just looking to help us, you to help us digest this package the government unveiled to deal with the spiralling cost of fuel. How would you rate it?
Out of 10, probably 2. Maybe lower. The reality is this here. People getting into a filling station this morning where the 20 cent a litre of diesel has been reduced, those people are still paying 35 to 36 extra for a litre of diesel than they were on the 1st of March. You're paying 8 to 10% extra for a litre of petrol. So that, I think, tells a whole lot of what or how it failed yesterday. I mean, if Simon Harris wanted to make a statement on this, he would have aimed for 40 cent of a cut. 40 cent a litre, because this cut will be absorbed within the next week, if not earlier, because I would know from talking to some of the retailers over the weekend, they were offered diesel at an unaffordable price. They simply couldn't take it. It was up to 18, 19 cent a litre extra.
This is from wholesale, is it?
From wholesale.
Yeah.
See, the wholesale has very little control in a hugely volatile international market. I mean, we're looking to the CEO of Fuels Ireland doing his best to explain it. But the reality is the wholesalers are not to blame for it. And, this notion of price gouging was put out in the Dáil initially by Micheál Martin before he went off on the St. Patrick's Day break. And Simon Harris began asking people who were witnessing price gouging to contact him or to contact the authorities. They've never mentioned it ever since that, because it's not there. I suppose at the end of the day, this is going to be revisited time and time again. I think there's numbers of good contributions made in the Dáil yesterday evening, one of the best from Kieran O'Callaghan of the Sock Dems, when he just told Simon Harris that as a consequence of the budget, the lowest paid and the poorest paid and those in social welfare were worse off by 4%. So you now have this imposition of another 20 cent a litre on diesel, and that's going to keep rising and rising, and this isn't going to be visited again until May. That simply is not acceptable. And I don't know where we go from that, because the government seems incapable of handling these kind of crises.
But from what I can determine, John, and maybe you can give me better information, to make sure that the government don't breach EU guidelines, my understanding is there has to be a minimum of a 33% or cent on a litre of VAT. Isn't that correct? Not VAT, but excise.
Excise.
Yeah, so that really leaves only an 8 cent bit of wiggle room because they reduced it down 20, and it leaves them about 8. So when you're saying they should have gone down as far as 40, where is the headroom in the overall cost of a litre to sort of make space for that?
Well, the reality of this here is that they have 60 cent of excise duty off a litre of petrol, or 65% off a litre of petrol. So they've only cut a very tiny amount off that. They have 60 cent a litre in excise duty off diesel. So they only cut 20 cent a litre of that. So like they could double that and
but like not without breaching EU regulations though. There is a minimum there.
I don't think they'll be breaching EU regulations at that because we're in an emergency situation and those regulations are for very normal times because they're going to be forced into doing that anyway. And they're going to be forced into a lot of other very unpalatable issues like 2008 when we had this kind of crisis, probably not quite as bad as this. The onboard snip, if you remember, Colin McCarthy's onboard snip, cut 5.5 billion off the public services. Thousands and thousands of jobs were cut. And it'll be the simplest thing in the world for them to go in there and just start slash and burn with the public services because there's 425,000 people employed there. And they will have a look at that. They're probably having a look at that now anyway. But they'll have a look at a lot of other things as well. They'll have a look at community care and they will hit the most vulnerable. They always do that. They done it in 83, they done it in 2008.
That's if we head towards a recession, I presume you're talking of.
Well, I think we are heading towards a recession from listening to the international experts on CNN and on the BBC Newsnight. They're all seeing nothing but a recession, which could be in the order of, but our inflation at the moment is low. It's 2.7%. It could easily, because we have seen nothing at all yet because it hasn't trickled down, we could easily see 7, 8 and 10% before the summertime.
And I saw one financial expert, well-regarded internationally, said that if the crude oil per barrel gets to 150 and sits around 150, it will trigger a global recession. So that would actually speed things up, exacerbate the situation.
Probably as it now is, in or around that $100 a barrel, which is what Brent crude is trading at, instead of 75 or 74. That is dangerous territory because as that sits there, I mean, this crisis could be going on this time next year, even if there's agreement tomorrow that we'll go into some kind of talks. The first thing you don't believe is anything Donald Trump says, because this time last week he was crediting the fact that the success of their operations, that they had killed all the leading military in Iran. Now he says that he's talking to them.
Well, I think he's created a problem for himself there, actually, because I think the leadership of Iran now is so fractured that it's going to be very difficult to get any binding agreement, because who do you talk to? You can't just pick your most favourable couple of individuals in Iran if they can't. You know, we're talking about a country of 90 million people here. You know, and those at least that wield some power in Iran are saying this guy's negotiating with himself. We've got the world where we want them. You know, it's not about bombs and missiles and leadership. It's about the flow of oil, the flow of goods. And Iran clearly have outwitted Donald Trump.
Absolutely. But I think what is worse than that is that there is no real solution at this point, after almost a month, to the blockages in the Gulf of Hormuz. And until that is fully resolved and cleared, if they're going to start escorting those huge giant tankers with 850 barrels of oil in them, can you imagine the cost that is going to be? That's going to drive, like, inflation is going to go up. There's, like, we're not used to that. Like, we're not too badly fixed as a government. We have our finances are in fairly good order, not massive. We couldn't afford to be throwing away more than 20 billion. We could afford to spend that much because you can also borrow. There's nothing to stop us borrowing. I mean, our national debt is at a low ebb of about 209 billion. So we're pretty well fixed. And
the bank's well financed too, in fairness, which is a difference to the last crash. Home heating oil. There was nothing really in it that's going to have a massive impact in terms of savings on a fill, John. There is a very moderate reduction. You can't help but feel, and I don't want to cry, you know, poor Donegal again, but much of this country relies on home heating oil and much of it doesn't. And you can't help but feel that maybe where the seats of power are doesn't rely very much on home heating oil, and therefore that was excluded in this range of measures.
I was talking to Patrick McLaughlin this day 2 weeks, and we were writing about that element of it. This is a West of Ireland problem. We don't have services. I mean, we have nothing out and into Donegal apart from truck deliveries. And that's going to drive up the price of groceries on the shelves, because you have those big trucks doing about 3 or 4 miles to the gallon. That hasn't kicked in yet, or else they're holding off on it. But it will kick in probably by Easter week. That will drive inflation. That's the first thing that will start driving inflation. Is people are complaining that food has got very expensive. People are saying there's a 6 or 7% inflation in food, and there probably is, because I wouldn't do that much shopping altogether, but a couple of times a week I would suddenly realise that amount I spent is up by another 10 or 12.
Do you know what, in a way it's easier for you, I think, perhaps to track it, because, you know, when you've got a smaller basket you'd be more conscious of that. But in fairness to the government, they did significantly increase the diesel rebate for the haulage industry. The haulage industry does seem to have a good access to the ear of government, so maybe that might offset those concerns you have to some extent.
Farmers in construction will be hugely disappointed, because they have huge demands for oil. I mean, this day of the year, your farm contractor is burning 1,000 litres of oil a day. You know, how are they going to cope with that there? There's going to be some rebate on farm oil, but it's going to be nowhere near. I mean, as an example of that, burning farm diesel has increased by 19 cent an hour. And that's a huge amount of money, spread over a day, you know, spread over 1,000 litres. It's 19 euro an hour, actually. But right along the way, we haven't tackled this issue at all in any meaningful way, because it's very possible that the cuts made yesterday will be wiped out over the weekend. Where do we go then?
Well, I think really the problem is with the increases in the last couple of days, we've only gone back to where we were on Friday or Saturday, 204. The only hope that we have, though, is that Donald Trump is so unpredictable, he can declare a victory of sorts. If the Iranians say, right, we can frame this in a way where, you know, we come out looking okay, Trump can pull out at any point if he wants to. We're kind of reliant, I think, on the Iranians and the Israelis. We could see the price of oil fall quite rapidly, quite quick. I mean, it might not happen, but it could happen as well. And I think that's where all our fingers are crossed.
Well, first of all, the amount of damage done to the infrastructure in the Emirates and in Iran and in the Gulf of Hormuz could take months and months to resolve. In fact, that massive gas explosion.
5 years, the Qataris stated.
5 years, yeah. I mean, the reality here is that 40% of our electricity is generated from diesel. So there's going to be no easy, quick fix solution. The government might want us to believe what they actually believe themselves, and is that after a couple of weeks things will settle down. That's not going to happen. There's nobody on any international forum discussing any big solutions within not this year. There may be some easing off, and there may not be, because there's also this reality that things could also get worse. If Trump walks away, as he said last week, we don't need the Gulf of Hormuz in the USA. We don't use it, so it shouldn't be any of our business. I mean, is he going to walk away and just leave it like that? There's a great possibility, because he'll make 3 or 4 different statements every single day on Truth Social, and every one of them is different. I mean, last night he was talking preposterously about himself and the Ayatollah policing the Gulf of Hormuz. Now, this is absolute and utter madness. Like, that can't happen. But he's obviously not listening to his chiefs of staff at all. Probably if he was, they might not have the war might not have started the way it did, because some of them will say that enough progress was made with the negotiations with the Iranians to hold off on it, and that it was Israel that actually jumped the gun, and it probably was. But now that that they're embedded in there, because remember, America has never won a war, going back to Vietnam and Korea and all of those things, they left it with devastation, body bags, tens of thousands of them coming back home. But what is driving Trump probably at the moment is that he's getting hits in America, because the cost of gas at the filling station is heading for $5 a gallon?
Which is a big deal in the United States. We'd take that, yes. but it's a big deal. And even though he might say they only rely on 2 or 3% of oil going through Hormuz, the reality is they are still affected by the global situation.
They're going to be affected by increased prices.
They're not insulated, of course.
If their fuel has doubled in price, the supermarket prices will also be hit with that. So they're looking to midterm elections in November time, and his ratings are not all that high as they stand. So whether the Republican Party even listened to him or whether he bothers talking to them, the ordinary American families will see a damage, and they'll be looking to him for a damage limitation, because costs are going to rise there. They're also going to have inflation. But we have a unique situation in that we have a decent surplus. It's not going to carry us for too long, but say 6 months, we should be okay.
Yeah.
But why Simon Harris stuck at 20% yesterday is inexplicable, and it's just simply not good enough. But then again, this government has got very little right in the last 18 months.
Well, we'll hear from the government in the second hour, in the interests of balance. John McAteer, thank you very much indeed. Always a pleasure. And John's got his scarf on, I noticed. Maybe he's being conscious with the thermostat. So we'll be getting a government perspective on it. 20 cent on diesel, 15 on petrol, a little bit on home heating oil, extension of the... an increase in the rebate for hauliers and some bus companies. I'm going to get some clarity from the government minister we have on later in relation to that. The winter fuel allowance being extended as well. So there's a lot in there. That's John McAteer's assessment of it. But maybe you feel that, right, OK, given the constraints that we have, that the government has stepped up here and made our lives a little bit easier. Now, we heard yesterday the family of Amy Doherty, who was killed in Derry, have said they've been crushed with disbelief, sadness and pain. A 30-year-old man has been arrested on suspicion of the murder of the mother of two on Saturday and is still being questioned by police. Amy was found injured at a property in Summer Meadows Mews at about 20 past 10 and later died in hospital. Her parents, Patrick and Sharon, said her bubbly character and fun-loving spirit lifted the hearts of all who met her. They said Amy was the best mother to her two children and that her life revolved around her love and care of them. Her parents said she was also loved by her two brothers. Please pray for us all at this time, the statement read. And I know many of you had. And I know many, many people have been touched by this on a very personal level. And there are a number of events taking place, I suppose, to stand in solidarity with Amy Doherty and her family. I'll speak first with Eleanor Lamb, I beg your pardon, who's chairperson of Lifeline in Ashone. Thank you for joining us, Eleanor.
Thank you very much, Greg.
And, obviously this is an incredibly personal tragedy for Amy and her family, but I presume too, there's been a real personal sort of sense to this from you and your colleagues in Lifeline in Ashone, but also your service users as well.
Well, absolutely. I mean, an event like this is very triggering for so many people who have experienced domestic abuse in Ireland on both sides of the border. The statistic now, I believe, is that one in three women within their lifetime will experience some form of domestic abuse. And I think it's one in six young women in the between the ages of 18 and 25. So it's not just a problem within marriage. It's a problem throughout a woman's life. It can be a problem and an issue.
And unfortunately, as shocking and devastating this news is, it's not unfamiliar now at this stage. We are hearing all too often of cases like this, women suffering serious injury, and, you know, statistics from organisations like yourselves nationally or other local organisations. There's no let up in cases and instances of domestic abuse. And with all the conversation and all the awareness, it feels sometimes like things are getting worse. That's not just a feeling, that's a fact.
Yes, there seems to be, at the minute, there seems to be an absolutely epidemic of similar issues. I mean, the front page of the Irish News yesterday was full of two different articles about domestic abuse, an article on Amy Doherty and an article about the conviction of McCullough for the murder of Natalie McNally in Lurgan. Then we had, not too long ago, I think it was last week, we had in Middleton, Adam Corcoran, convicted for the murder of his partner, Dana Walsh, who, like Amy Doherty, was a mother of two children. And we mustn't forget the children in this, because it's a terribly traumatic event for children to have to suffer the loss of their mother in such a way. It's something that will live with them for the rest of their lives.
Eleanor, before we talk about the candlelight vigil on Friday, should we use this opportunity to maybe try and reach out to or get a message to people who might be living in a domestic abuse situation?
Yes, basically, I mean, Lifeline wants to tell these women, you are not alone. We are there, and there are other support services. Lifeline, we offer a listening ear. We offer a helpline, court accompaniment. We have a counselling service for both adults and children. We run various courses, which will help to break down the isolation, which a lot of these women who are in particularly coercive control situations may be experiencing. And we have schools programs too, to try and promote the idea of the awareness of what the difference between a healthy and a toxic relationship is. So that's just a sample of the sort of things we do.
And if someone is in that situation, Eleanor, and listening to us now, and holding on, thinking things might change, or holding on because they're thinking of the children or the family or the neighbours or whatever it might be. I mean, obviously people have to do what's right for them in the moment, but what is your message to someone who is sort of enduring this type of an existence, maybe seeing the behaviour going from financial control to physical abuse or degrading abuse or whatever it might be? What is your message to those women?
Our message is to reach out, to look for support, to work through what they want to do. They have to be in control of their decisions. They have to decide what's the best for them and for their children. But very often the best is to get out, because red flags are raised for a reason. And quite often the victims of murder by their partners or ex-partners haven't actually suffered physical abuse before, but they have suffered coercive control. And it can go from one end of the spectrum right across to the very far end, and these women end up dead. It's not very often a gradual thing. So they're in a dangerous situation. They need to get out. And we also have a message for the politicians, that Jenny's Law needs to be passed, and it needs to be passed urgently. The politicians were able to rush through legislation to save the banks during the banking crisis. Mm. They need to rush through this Jenny's Law to save women now. Jenny's Law has been going through the Oireachtas and is named after a woman called Jennifer Poole, who was killed by her ex-partner. And it transpired later, after he was convicted, that he had also been convicted of another issue of serious domestic violence in the past. So Jenny's Law is to establish a publicly accessible register of all of those convicted of domestic abuse.
And I think that also has to have a cross-border element to it, particularly given where we are living, that the two authorities or whomever might be responsible can speak to each other. I mean, every week I get an email, a tax defaulters list of people who have failed to pay revenue 22 grand or something like that, and they're named and shamed, their addresses are given, their business address, everything is given. I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but when we could be doing something that doesn't even go that far that could help protect people, it's astonishing the foot dragging that's ongoing.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you're dead right about the need for a cross-border issue there, particularly in the area we live in. We're having the vigil.
Yeah, we'll get to that now. It is 7 p.m. on Friday, the 27th of March, outside Lifeline Inishowen Centre. So invite people, and for what reasons, Eleanor?
Well, we want to stand in solidarity with Amy Doherty's family, but also the families of all of those people who've been victims or survivors of domestic abuse and of their families. We will be releasing 30 balloons, one for each woman in the north of Ireland who's been killed since 2020, and a large white balloon for all the women in Inishowen and further afield who have been survivors of domestic abuse or victims and of their families. And we will have some music at it as well. The Lifeline premises is, as you turn off the road into Super Value, it's a building on the left, but you'll see it. Hopefully there'll be plenty of people there. So 7 o'clock on Friday, and we hope that a lot of people will turn up. There's also one in Derry at the Guildhall, and I believe there's one in Armagh as well.
Indeed, and we're going to speak to the one, about the one in Derry very shortly. Thank you very much, Eleanor. I do appreciate your time, Eleanor Lamb there. So maybe it will suit you to get along to Bunkrana outside the offices of Lifeline in Inishowen, 7 p.m. on Friday at the same time. At the Guildhall steps in Derry, the Alliance for Choice Derry have organised a vigil, and Bethany Moore of that organisation joins me now. Bethany, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having us.
Right, why were you moved to get involved in the organisation of this vigil?
We were moved to organise this vigil, Greg, because we really felt that we need to stand together as a city, as a town, as a community to offer our support and our solidarity to the family of Amy Doherty. This is just horrific. I think the feeling in the town is one of a real sense of heaviness. There is an immense outpouring of grief. As you mentioned about Amy's family statement, you know, there's so many in the town that are affected by her passing, her friends, her loved ones, her family, her children, and her colleagues, you know, and it affects the city and the community as a whole. So we really wanted to just hold space for people to come together and to acknowledge the loss of Amy, to stand with her family, and also to acknowledge the loss, as Eleanor had mentioned, of the 29 other women who have been killed in the north since 2020.
And I think a strong showing in all of the venues that we've discussed so far might also send a message to those who are the victims of domestic abuse, or indeed the perpetrators of it. I'm not sure these men can be reasoned with, and I'm not sure what impact it might have on them. But whatever, just to even show how unacceptable this is to any society but our society, that this, so that's why I feel a big crowd at all of these events. It's multifaceted, you know, the impact it might have.
It is, Greg. I think, you know, we can't underestimate the impact of these vigils and these shows of solidarity. You know, as you mentioned, there's one taking place in Derry, the one that we're hosting, and that is this Friday, the 27th of March at 7 p.m. We're encouraging people to come, to show up, to show support and love for Amy's family, to acknowledge the lives of the 29 other women that have been lost. We're encouraging people to bring candles and flyers. But there's also vigils taking place, as you said, in Buncrana and Armagh. I think there's one that has just been organised for Belfast City Hall as well on Friday. Mm-hmm. And I think that really highlights the importance that this is an issue that affects everyone. You know, Eleanor was on talking about the lives of the women that have been lost in the south as well. This feels relentless. It is an island-wide issue, but particularly for us in the north as well, we are really seeing an epidemic of it at the minute. I mean, Ellie Flanagan was murdered as recently as 2 to 3 weeks ago. And I think, you know, as Eleanor was also saying, when you look at the news, there's so many other stories of convictions. Natalie McNally,
Sorry, I beg your pardon. I thought you were finished there. I was going to say that doesn't even talk to the tens of thousands of calls to support organisations across the island as well, and instances. And this is what really is bothering, instances of domestic abuse in the home that can go on for a decade more and never gets reported. And those women and men too, of course, but primarily women in the context of what we're speaking about now, their voices aren't necessarily heard, but maybe they will be at this vigil in Derry. It's at 7 p.m. on the Guildhall steps in Derry, in Buncrana outside Lifeline, in Sean's offices as well. Bethany, thank you for your time. I do appreciate it. Both of those at 7 p.m. If any more of those are taking place, or if you're deciding to hold one in your local area, please let me know and I'll let the listeners know. As a carer, I see it happen to men all the time by their wives, especially when they are reliant on their wives for support. Domestic violence does not relate to one gender. And we're getting a few calls in relation to this. And I hope long-term listeners to this show would understand that everybody knows that domestic violence, men can be victims of violent domestic violence from their male partners, female partners, women as well. But domestic violence against men is a very, very serious problem. But a young mum of two has just been murdered, and she's only the latest of a whole host of women. And women in Donegal have been murdered in domestic violence situations. The overwhelming majority of people reaching out for help are women. And I understand fellas are affected by this too, but if we could just maybe focus on this just for now, because this is what the vigil's about. I recognise that men suffer from domestic violence as well, but if you want to talk about the scale of domestic violence suffered by women versus men, you know, one case against one gender or other is not good. But my point is there is a massive, massive problem with women being abused in the home, abused in the street, abused going about their everyday business. There are women dying on a regular basis. There are women winding up in hospital on a regular basis. I'm aware of a very serious case recently that is not being, it's not public as such. So an awful lot goes on. It's primarily women. We're not forgetting the fellas, but this is about a young mum who's the 30th woman in Northern Ireland to die through domestic abuse. And whilst we recognise men are victims too, please, for the moment, understand that this is not really the time for a gender war, in my view, that this is more just about dealing with what we're dealing with now. And we talk about domestic violence, coercive control, parental alienation against men and women all of the time. But we're just in a space now where we're focusing, not exclusively, but understanding that these vigils are about the dozens and dozens and dozens of women who have been murdered in domestic violence situations at the hands of men around this country in recent years. Some of your texts coming in so far. It's heartbreaking to learn of Amy's death, says a listener. Personally, my sister was in a domestic violence situation. One evening while visiting, I walked in on an incident happening. She would under no circumstances leave. He since died and she has him honoured like a king. I can never understand the thinking of women in these situations. What can we do to make women see they need to leave and there's support available? But it's like anything. You can only really be helped when you want to be helped, be that an addiction or being in an environment. All you can do, I suppose, is leave that door open always for a person to step through. All domestic abuse is terribly wrong, but it does not only happen to females, just like... Oh, here we are. I was waiting. I'll come back to that actually in a second, because that sounds like I'm being dismissive and I'm not. Can she stop saying women, men are also in the same situation? Don't insulate them. Yep, no, we never will do that. But as I said just before the break there, we are talking about the death of a young mum, the 30th woman in Northern Ireland to die in a domestic abuse situation. And unfortunately, we've lost many women in Donegal and across the Republic of Ireland as well as a result of this situation. And domestic violence services are inundated with calls relating to this. Some of the, at the weekend, a lot of the work of Donegal Gardaí is going to houses to deal with domestic violence situations. There's an awful lot goes on that's not talked about, of course. Not least as well, too, that you quite rightly point out that men can be victims of coercive control, domestic abuse, etc. On the issue of fuel, and dozens of you have been messaging in, how come petrol stations were able to rise prices overnight when even though the fuel they have was bought at the cheaper price, but then when it was bought at a dearer price and the price lowers, it seems to be acceptable to say they can hold the price high as it was bought at the higher price. It depends on what VAT was taken off it, or not VAT, what tax was taken off it, because if it was VAT, the VAT is charged as they sell it. If it's excise duty, the excise duty is bought, is paid when they buy it. So if someone in the industry can correct me if I'm wrong there. So that's what I believe to be what's going on there. On Sunday, I passed a number of petrol stations and watched them increase the prices, and they'd bought it in advance. And now the profit makers, retailers, are price gouging regardless of what they're saying. Hi, Greg. I drove from Remelton to work in Letterkenny this morning. Not one station had reduced its prices yet. They were quick to put them up at the first sniff of war, but now aren't bothered. That comes in from Jar. Again, I don't want to sound like I'm the spokesperson for retailers. I'm certainly not. But they will only sell new diesel and petrol that comes into stock at the lower price because of the nature of the tax that was reduced on it. So they're still selling the petrol and diesel they bought at the higher price until such time as they get their next delivery. Now, some people might say, oh, yeah, well, but, and that's fine. Really what should have happened is that they should have been able to seek a rebate on the stuff they'd already bought. That would have made a lot more sense. Greg, the government are boasting about this €250 million package for cost of living. No one seems to mention the fact that before the war, the government were taking 23% VAT on fuel at €1.74 a litre. Now they're taking 23% on the current price of 205 cents a litre. Yeah, it's about an extra 10 cent a litre in tax. Why did the fertiliser go up? These haulier companies were getting 7.5 cent a litre rebate already, now getting 12 cent a litre and backdated to the 1st of January, yet the fertiliser went up because of road diesel. Fertiliser, even helium, a lot of stuff comes out of Qatar and it comes through that strait that has been Hormuz, that has been closed. There's lots of things affected by the by oil tyres, for an example. You know, obvious stuff and less obvious stuff. Anything that is made or oil is a derivative of oil or uses oil as a derivative will go up in price. Some of it straight away, some of it will take time. The petrol and diesel is still the same at my local petrol station, and I thought that the prices were due to come down at midnight. But that would have been if there was a delivery between midnight and when you looked at the prices. That's the only way you would have seen those reductions. Okay, let's stay with the roads. Mark Creighton is a driving instructor at Get to Drive. He joins us now. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Greg. Thanks for having me on.
Now, you ply your trade mostly in the Inishowen area, don't you?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
So there's Carndon and the Vale, that kind of area.
And so you get to see an awful lot and you've got a few observations for us, right? And it's not infrequent, I presume, because you've got the dash cam front and rear in the car, so you're picking up a lot of stuff.
Absolutely. It's not just one instance, to be totally fair to you. You know, it reflects a bigger pattern of impatience that I'm seeing on the road. You know, people are impatient. They're making silly decisions because of that. And I see it every day.
Yeah, right. Talk to me about this instance you witnessed recently of a quad overtaking. I'm showing a video to our viewers at the moment, those who are watching the show. Yep. Really quite shocking, given all the warnings about the dangers of quads on the roads.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the most dangerous things I'd seen in a long time, to be honest with you. It happened on Friday evening. I was travelling with a learner between Mavelle and Caen, and a quad bike overtook two cars, myself and one behind. Solid white line, wrong side of the road. They had no protective gear, no helmets, nothing. You know, the white line is there for a reason. It doesn't mean overtake. So what we saw wasn't judgment or anything like that. It was just, you know, pure luck that nothing was coming in the opposite direction. You know, and they proceeded on down the road and crossed over again onto the other side of the road for no reason. You know, what really hit me here was the learner beside me, all right? I'm asking them to be calm, safe, you know, and then they're faced with something like that. And it can knock their confidence so quickly. It's unreal. You know, the bigger issue, you know, a lot of what I'm seeing isn't a lack of driving ability. It's just impatience. Mm. You know, people are taking serious risks here just to save a few seconds. You know, the simple message is, if it's not clearly safe and legal, don't do it. You know, on our the roads in Donegal, you don't get a second chance. They're unforgiving. You know, and this particular instance was appalling. It really, really was.
And everything's wrong with it. Firstly, there's no protection there. You said, what, were they doing about 60 kilometres per hour? There's lights missing from the back. There's no number plates, no insurance, no tax. Wrong Absolutely. Side of the road. I mean, it really is just the full bingo, full house of what not to do.
And it's asking for trouble. It's exactly that. It's, you know, just to be clear, this kind of overtake could easily have ended in a head-on collision. You know, and you're thinking, you know, there's two families, the two lads on the quad bike. There's two people in my car. There's two people in the car behind. You know, there's two people coming towards us, possibly in a lorry, a van, any, you know, a car, anything. You know, you're talking there. You know, there's eight families that would be affected by this. Mm. You know, whether that's physically, mentally, or anything. You know, and they're just not thinking this stuff through. They really aren't.
Yeah, and that is it's a shocker. There's just no doubt about that watching it. You also sent us in a video, something we see more frequently. And I actually, when I watched this a few times, I'm going to be honest with you, Mark, I would see this so often, I was like, what's this video of? Do you know that sort of a way? Because it's really sort of dangerous, but quite familiar behaviour. So this is a car pulling out just up from the petrol station.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, coming out from the petrol station, they're turning right, and you've got a novice driver coming down the hill in a red Mini. And as she comes down the hill, she's anticipating that he's going to pull out, which is brilliant. And he pulls out just in front. There's no judgment. He takes no, does no or very little observation. And the thing that struck me with that one is she drove past me, obviously, on the opposite side, and she looked straight at me. And the look of fear on her face was just like, you know, what just happened there? You know, and this person is still within 2 years of getting their driving license. Now, I don't know whether that's a month in or whether that's, you know, 23 months in, but she looked completely fearful in her face. You know, and that is just impatience again. That's all it is.
Yeah, because there's nothing else coming down behind that red Mini. I'm not sure what traffic is behind you, but I would imagine that driver would probably have to wait a maximum of 20 seconds to avoid that dangerous manoeuvre.
That's exactly it. Yeah. Absolutely that. Absolutely that. You know, and even there would have been time to terminate the manoeuvre, you know, but it just kept coming. That was the thing that struck me most of all. You know, it's a nightmare out there at the moment.
Is it poor judgment? Is it don't care less attitude? Is it impatience? What do you think is... we have to separate out the two people on the quad, because that's just... that's mindless. I really worry about what might happen to them down the line, because the fun for them was the weaving around the road, the double overtake, the speed.
Of course.
But I suppose that the pulling out in front of the other drivers is more everyday type of behaviour. Is it impatience, lack of awareness? What is it, do you think?
It's just complete impatience. I think as a society, we've become a lot more impatient. Just in general. And I think now, you know, we're making these moves just to save a few seconds. You know, 20 seconds we're talking about on that particular one. Would it really have made much difference to that person's life? You know, and the effect that that's now had on that novice driver, you know, that novice driver will be worrying about that certainly for the rest of that day and thinking, God, you know, was that me? Was it my fault? You know, she was completely in the right and she made the right call, you know, because she'd already started to ease off because she's seen him stick his nose out from that junction. Mm-hmm. And I truly believe a lot of these accidents are in relation to impatience. We just need to be more patient when we're driving.
What kind of patience do you see for your learners? You know, we do hear reports from other parts of the county where people are up the backside of a learner driver or bibbing the horn or flashing lights or dangerous overtaking, even though they're fully, they have full awareness that there's someone in there learning how to drive. Do you see much of that in Inishowen?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point. I mean, yesterday I was down in Carn with a learner, and they were turning right. I think it was down onto Bridge Street. And she's early days. She stalled the car, perfectly normal. She, you know, reset herself, handbrake neutral, the usual stuff. And the car behind us hooted. And I kind of turned and looked at them, and they looked away. They didn't make eye contact with me or anything like that. And it's like, well, why are you hooting them? There's absolutely nothing wrong with what they're doing. Everybody has to start somewhere. You know, and this young learner, she was like, did I do something wrong there? It was like, no, you just stalled it. It was just one of them things, you know. And she was, to be fair to her, she reset herself. She was calm. You know, we just got on with the day. But, you know, I see it. If I'm driving, you know, I've got L plates on the car. Obviously, if I'm going from A to B, from my home down into Mobile, say, you know, I can be doing 75, 76, something like that. I'm still getting cars coming past me in excess of 80 kilometres, you know, on the 80-kilometre roads. It's just impatience. And for some reason, L plates just seem to be a red rag.
Yeah, all right.
You know, to a bull.
Finally and separately, Mark, 18 weeks. I checked yesterday. Yep. The 18 weeks is the waiting time for one of your graduates, if I could call it that, from invite to actually getting a driving test. It's crazy. It's gone backwards in Inishowen. I thought we were making some inroads, but 4.5 months to wait to sit a test. It's crazy, hasn't it?
It's absolutely shocking. Now, I kind of predicted this time last year, there was all the big fanfare about, you know, we're going to do tests on Saturdays. We're going to, you know, throw more money at it. They threw more money at it. It was great. You know, we got all the time, the waiting list down. The money ran out at the end of September. And I said this time last year, I bet this time next year we're going to be in the same boat. And that's the way we're going. Mm. We're going back to where we were again, which is really sad. And I don't blame the examiners or anything like that. You know, it's just a lack of resources.
Ironically, we could be in a worse situation because of retests going through the system now, post-rush, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, retests now have been merged in with regular bookings, so the waiting times for them are going to be the same. But yeah, I wouldn't surprise me. I mean, before long, we're going to be back to the 20-24 week delays, I think.
Okay, Mark, thanks for that. Mark Creighton there, driving instructor at Get to Drive. By the way, I just need to point something out. I've interviewed and talked to the people, the wonderful people at Lifeline Inishowen, for years and years and years. And I know fine rightly they're in Carn Donagh and not Buncrana. But when I was plugging the event, I did mention Buncrana. But of course, it is in Carn Donagh. That's Friday night, Friday evening at 7 p.m. Now we are joined by Minister for State at the Department of Transport, Minister Sean Canny. Thank you very much for joining us, Minister.
Good morning.
Right, OK, so we kind of knew most of the details before they were announced, but I'm sure what the government would see is a significant intervention in the cost of living crisis in context of the war in the Middle East.
Yes, it's a $250 million support package. It's a support package. It helps people who are buying their fuel at the pump. It also provides assistance for people who are in fuel poverty by extending the fuel allowance. That will benefit 470,000 households. And the other area where we have is the put in support is in the area of transport and the VAT. What you call it, the rebate scheme, and that's to help the logistics in our country, which we rely so heavily on, and also for private coach operators and public and providing public transport, that they see that there is a support there for them. And that support is basically to increase the rebate and also to backdate it to the 1st of January, because they claim their VAT every 3 months, and it's important that they be able to claim some of that rebate now, at the end of April, at the end of March, so that they have some money in cash flow to help them with the additional costs that are there. And I'll be honest and I'll be blunt, it's what we brought in doesn't solve every problem, but it attempts to try and mitigate and to help people who need the help. And when you take places, rural Ireland, where I'm from, you know, we don't have the same access to public transport. So it's important that people who have to buy petrol or diesel for their cars, that they actually are getting assistance.
And unfortunately, I mean, we couldn't be naive and hope that the intervention would bring us back to prices before the US and Israel started their action against Iran. But unfortunately, the way prices moved, it kind of has only brought us back to Friday or Saturday, because over the weekend and early this week, quite coincidentally, I presume it's a coincidence, you know, wholesale prices increased by pretty much 20 cent a litre of diesel.
And I suppose this is the, I suppose, the volatility that's in the market. And if you saw yesterday where President Trump made some announcement in relation to Iran, and all of a sudden the price of crude oil dropped by 13% on the world market. We haven't seen that reflected in the pumps as well. So I'm sure if it's going the other way, we might see a quicker reaction. And I'm not blaming the people who are the retailers at the forecourts, because they're getting their fuel from reputable wholesalers. It is a difficult market, and the way they pay for their oil is based on markets.
Is there enough transparency in the wholesale sector? Because, you know, it would be nice to know exactly what's going on.
Yeah, well, it's a bit like everything else. You know, the chain of supply probably needs a bit more scrutiny, and it's something that I've learned in the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks. How does the price of fuel, how does it change? Where does it change? What triggers a change, and how quickly can it be changed? But all I know that from some people I've talked to this morning, that the price at the forecourt this morning has seemed to be dropped from last night. And I think I want to compliment the forecourt operators for their, I suppose, total honesty in passing on.
But they can only pass on new supply. And as a West of Ireland representative, you will understand that my local petrol station, for an example, they could have 4 or 5 days worth of fuel bought at the higher rate in their tanks. Would it not have been advisable from the government to have some sort of a rebate system that would allow, you know, maybe the low flow forecourts to pass on these savings at midnight and then seek a rebate from government? And it would also have made the messaging far more clearer and everything, you know, because you can imagine I have quite literally hundreds of comments of people frustrated that their local station haven't dropped the prices, and it's really bad for retail. I just think the government could have had some sort of a rebate system in there to allow everyone go at the lower price from 12.
Well, I think what we needed to do was to put in measures which would take effect immediately. And okay, there would be a day or two or 3 days in areas where the delivery comes every 3 or 4 days. But this was something that we had to enact. Legislation had to come into the door last night to be passed on it so that we could put it in place. When you're doing something in an emergency, you're doing something that you're trying to help people as quickly as possible. And this is the best way to do it. It is the cleanest way to do it. And under legislation, it is also the quickest way to do it. And I would say to people, you know, this is not a permanent, what I would call, reduction. We have to look at this. We have to, it will be effective till the end of May. But in the meantime, and we all know this, we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We don't know what's going to happen the next day. So what we have to do is keep the situation under, monitor it, keep doing the analysis as to where what's happening with the entire economy as a result of the additional costs. And so, for instance, I know for sure that agriculture is affected by it. Fertilizer will be affected by it, the cost of it. That's the basic ingredient for food production. We also have a situation where construction materials are going up in price as a result of this. So that's why transport costs play a big part in all of that. Mm. So that is why we have put in the VAT rebate scheme for hauliers and also for bus operators.
Bus operators, including private school transport operators, those that might be subcontracted by Bus Éireann, they all can benefit from that rebate, can they?
If they're part of the VAT rebate scheme, yes, absolutely.
Now, is that not? There's an awful lot of them that maybe can't afford to buy their diesel in bulk because you have to buy your diesel in huge quantities to qualify for that rebate. They can't claim VAT back any other way. Is that fair? Because that may not help the smaller bus companies who maybe were finding it tight on their tenders already. You know, who can't afford to buy it in the bulk. You've left them behind.
Not really, because they're buying it at the pump and they're getting the excise duty reduction in that. Okay. And I have to say that that's one area that I have a concern about is businesses who are in fixed contracts and they have to they've contracted to provide a service, whether it be a school bus or whether it is for special needs children, and they have to, they've provided it at a price and they've looked at the risk that was there when they priced it. And they're coming under severe pressure right now, and I acknowledge that. And that is something that, even with construction and public contracts, could be an issue. What our biggest problem here is we are living through a war. We don't know where it's going to go. There doesn't seem to be any coherent exit strategy to say, let's sit down and talk. We have all kinds of utterances, but we don't seem to have any kind of what I would call tangible evidence that there is a seriousness about bringing it, de-escalating. And as a country and as a government, our biggest asset at the moment is our reputation across Europe and across the world. And that's what we're doing with St. Patrick's Day when we went to all over the world to talk to other like-minded people and try and influence then the players in this war to get them to de-escalate.
You will be, as a West of Ireland representative, you will know that many of us here still rely on home heating oil. We've seen 500 litres go from anywhere from €450 up to €900 now. Very little in this package. Is it because these decisions are made in Dublin that the West Coast was left behind in terms of some support for just heating our homes, Sean, not a luxury? Yeah. Why was there not more done?
Because first of all, heating oil doesn't have excise duty on it, so we couldn't remove something that wasn't there. The next quickest thing we could do was to reduce the NORA levy on heating oil. And yes, I accept that heating oil is still very much a component for lots of people heating their homes. I would say that people who are in fuel poverty and are getting fuel allowance will get an extended fuel allowance for 4 weeks, which helps them. That has a positive effect on households up and down the country, 470,000 plus homes would benefit from that. Mm. In this particular, we brought in measures which are temporary. We brought in measures which will help people, not help everybody. And I everybody accepts that. We're not going to help everybody. But I think it's important, it was important, that we actually voted for these measures last night so they could be implemented. And I'm disappointed that Sinn Féin didn't vote. They voted against it. I don't know what the thinking was there. But what I'm saying is that it is important that the measures we've put in are temporary. They are something that we're reviewing on an ongoing basis. You can find a reason or you can find a criticism of everything that has been done. But at the end of the day, 250 million has been put back into the economy, into people's to support people.
But of
people.
Course, much of that is going to be paid for by the excess income the government has been receiving through increased VAT takes on fuel. It is our money as well, too, right? I mean, you know, it hasn't come out of Sean Canny and Micheál Martin's pockets. This is our money, you know.
Absolutely. And I would say that is why we have to be prudent with it. We also have to look at the long game. If we're coming into a winter where we're going to have this war still prevailing, we will have serious problems. And we need to make sure that we are ready to support again and again the taxpayer and the citizens in our state, so that we try and work our way through this.
Okay.
And the other concern we have is that, you know, our economy is in a good position at the moment. But with this is the most serious shock that has hit the world in a long, long time, probably the biggest oil crisis we've ever had and the most dramatic without any warning. So I think we have to look at the long game on this as well to make sure that we can actually support people in long term if that's what is required.
And just finally and briefly, because I know you're very busy, we must have an awful lot of school bus operators or private bus operators listening because I've got a fleet of messages in here. Did you say that you're looking at, you recognise that they may be tendered and are getting stuck in those tenders? You want to support them? Is that something that you said, or is that something that needs to be looked at? Or just, I don't want to misquote you after you've left the call.
What I've said is, I understand that private bus operators or anybody in a contract that was signed up to prior to this are now suffering. The VAT rebate scheme will help them, or if they are buying at the pump, the petrol that they're buying at the pump is down, the excise duty is down on that. That's what we're trying to do. That's what we have done to help people like that at the moment.
Okay.
But everything we're doing is predicated on, we don't know what's happening tomorrow. We don't know what's happening next Friday. We don't know what's happening next Monday. Mm-hmm. But I would be hopeful that sense would prevail and that we would start to get back to some normality. But that could take about 2 years as well. And we have to take cognizance of that as well.
You could have gone further, though. Very finally, there's still some headroom there. Why didn't you go the extra 8 or 9 cents that you possibly could have?
Yeah, you could argue you go an extra 8 or 9 cents, and then somebody say, why didn't you go another 10 cents?
Well, we can't because we're bound by European legislation. We're told
we are, and we also are. Have to make sure that whatever we're doing is sustainable and that what we're doing is temporary, and we may need to be adjusting all of this in the next couple of months.
Okay, listen, thank you very much for your time. It's greatly appreciated. That is Minister Sean Canny, an independent but part of the government, Minister for State at the Department of Transport. I'm joined by Dr. David Coleman, who's author of Fearless, the 10-step guide to helping children take charge of anxiety. Good morning. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Greg. How are you doing?
Good, good, good. We live in a world where, you know, more children are suffering with anxiety. I suppose they're exposed to everything. We were protected to some extent, though I still suffered from anxiety. But I think it's more broadly a problem. Now, we've never done more talking about it, be it in school or outside of school or what have you, and yet we are seeing statistics that point to different levels of anxiety, but then it can lead on to other issues like self-harm, mental illness, etc. Why are we seeing more children now struggling with anxiety, or perhaps maybe we're just more aware?
I think it's probably the latter. I think we're more aware of it. I think also some of that discourse on mental health, while, you know, mostly it's broadly positive, one of the things it has done is I think it's led a lot of parents, perhaps even their own teenage youngsters as well, to pathologize things like anxiety. So normal anxiousness is now often seen as a life-limiting condition as opposed to just a normal feeling that will come, you know, it's associated with a specific circumstance and then it will pass. And I think that has, probably explains a lot of what, you know, when we hear people saying like, oh, you know, my daughter has anxiety or I have anxiety. I think it's almost like people self-diagnose based on a lot of the conversations that are out there in society. But
so
are
you saying then that, you know, regular human emotions that we can potentially regulate or moods or what have you, we are over-amplifying them rather than dealing with them?
You never hear anybody going, oh, I have a fierce dose of happiness. Geez, I've had happiness for weeks. Whereas they will say that about sadness, or they will say that about anxiety. And so I absolutely think that we sometimes mislabel normal feelings as some kind of a condition or a disorder. I mean, that's not to say that there aren't things like anxiety disorders. Geez, you're very lucky nobody's handed me in a cup of coffee. Jeepers, there's bonus now. Bonus extra.
Go on.
The joys.
I'll have
Zoom.
A sub of it now. Go on.
Yeah, you might as well enjoy it. But I think there's definitely Yeah, I think more people will almost misdiagnose themselves because just, I suppose, partly that greater awareness. I mean, it's, you know, in many ways, as I say, it is a good thing that people are tuned in more. But the one downside, the danger is that we misrepresent normal feelings as something pathological.
You know, whether it's fight or flight or butterflies or what's excitement, what's fear, you know, what's protecting us, what's harming us. We need to understand what all of that is, though, right? So that's what you're going to help us with as part of these 10 steps, I presume. So, you know, what are these feelings? What's causing them? And then maybe we can better understand them.
For sure. I think so. The book Fearless is all about trying to understand exactly that. What is anxiety? How is it going to affect children in normal ways? When does it become something that is, in fact, problematic? But for the majority of children and teenagers, the anxieties that they feel are just a natural, normal fight or flight danger response system kicking into gear. So the butterflies in their tummy, the tension they might feel, their heart rate rising, feeling anxious,
sweaty palms.
Being worried, thinking in a worried way about things. These are all very normal responses to typical stimuli, like, you know, having to face an exam or having to stand up and give a presentation in their CBA in school, or being nervous because they're, you know, coming up to a big match and they want to do well and they're worried about their performance. Those are all very normal things. And so typically what we have to do in the first instance is find some strategy to just reduce the kind of physical sensation of anxiety. So we want to reduce the adrenaline that's flowing around the body. And so the best way to do that is usually some kind of relaxation exercise or a breathing exercise. If we can get a handle on the physicality of the anxiety, then it becomes possible to kind of broaden out the thinking again. Because often when children are very stuck in this feeling anxious and the physical sensation of anxiety, their thinking tends to be very negative as well. And it becomes a little bit muddled or a little bit addled. They can't really think clearly and rationally. Mm. So that's usually the next step, is to try to shift their thinking into a more positive
focus. And from there,
focus.
Then too, they start going to, you know, thinking in circles and all that type of stuff. It's right breaking that. But, you know, and I'm not making light of this at all, because there's a bit of me in this. How do anxious parents deal with anxious kids, right? So the teenager comes in, God, I'm feeling very anxious, Dad. And I'm like, what do you mean you're feeling anxious? What are you going to do? Are you okay? What am I going to do?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I think you're dead right. So there are very many things that can happen to your son or daughter that will often trigger experiences from your own growing up. So, for example, if you have a child who comes home and tells you that they were bullied and you had an experience of bullying when you were younger, then often we can feel a little bit re-traumatized, or we can certainly feel a bit overwhelmed by it, because perhaps we felt powerless ourselves when the bullying was happening to us. And now here we are faced with a situation where, again, as a parent, we feel powerless because we can't do anything to help our son or daughter. So I think it is really incumbent on us to try to regulate our own feelings first, to see if we can quell some of that anxiousness. Because for sure, if we start to freak out about the issue that our son or daughter is trying to explain to us or describe to us, then that's only going to add to their level of anxiety or their sensation of anxiety.
And is so that part of the rescue habit or separate to it?
It's not necessarily that it's about rescuing. I mean, for sure, as parents, we always want to be fixing problems. Mm. But I think if we're feeling anxious ourselves, then it's probably more to do with our own risk tolerance or our perception of danger. And once that gets triggered, we'll have all the same response of adrenaline flowing around the body. We'll have all the same potential to go into a kind of a really negative cycle of thinking and start to assume the worst and catastrophize about what might happen. And so we need to try to catch all of that, regulate a little bit, soothe ourselves enough that we can be calmer in responding to our son or daughter, because then we offer the possibility that we can give them a sense of confidence that this is actually just a problem. It's not a huge problem. It's a big enough problem that they're worried about it, but it's also something that might be fixable. And so I think when we can acknowledge their worries and acknowledge that their worries are valid, then they're much more likely to be able to listen to us if we are indeed suggesting, you know, solutions or ways to deal with an issue or strategies that they can use to calm themselves down. And and so I always talk about, you know, what we call an empathy first approach to problem solving, which is acknowledge the feeling, acknowledge the depth of their experience in terms of the intensity of the emotion. Because if you give any sense that you're dismissing it, your child is then likely to dismiss any efforts you make to problem solve with them. Whereas if you've acknowledged, yeah, look, this sounds like it really worries you. Oh, I could understand. That makes good sense. I can see why you're worried about it. And yet I don't know that you have to be that worried, because because here's what you can do, boom, 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 boom,
yeah,
boom, and
brilliant.
You give all these suggestions.
I do like your approaches, sorry, because when you are, as an adult or even as a child, but when you are suffering with anxiety, it's very lonely and it's very locked in, and it's worse when you are on your own and if you can't separate from yourself or reality or anything at all. It's just all in encompassing. And you have you can work with parents in educating them how you externalize the anxiety, right? Which sounds like it's cool. So it's there, but it is not all of you either.
Exactly. I mean, again, I think even when we, well, there's two things. One, when we just have a sense that all feelings are transient, all feelings are going to come and go. They might stick around for a little while, but they're eventually going to go. That you know, just because you have a feeling doesn't mean that what you're then thinking is the truth, because the feeling is going to influence how you're thinking. And so, you know, I mean, the book will give parents an insight into the whole kind of the core of cognitive behavioral therapy, in as much as how we think, how we feel, how we act, our physical selves are all interconnected and interrelated. So a change in one of those areas tends to have a knock-on change in some of the others. So if it's a negative change, if you're feeling anxious about something, then you're going to maybe think in an anxious way, you're going to avoid a situation. You know, chronic stress can lead to lots of physical problems as well. So if it's happening in a negative direction, it's going to have this knock-on negative effect all across the board. But that means also that if we change something in a positive way in one of those areas, so if somebody feels better, if they think in a positive way, if they do something to relieve the physical stress that they're experiencing, that will have a positive knock-on effect in all the other areas.
Yeah, but you're not just equipping people to deal with a particular period of anxiety. The 10 steps include tools that, you know, will help them deal with, so that could help them in social situations if they have to perform or in school, and carry through into their adult life as well. These are systems that are just life tools to take with you, is my reading of them.
Oh, 100%. I mean, I think if we can learn how to both understand the physicality of the anxiety, if we can learn to challenge our thinking, if we can, you know, find strategies to relax ourselves enough, if we can put ourselves in the way of the very thing that we're afraid of, so if we can experiment and have that kind of a growth mindset that it's okay to try something out, even if it doesn't work out, it's still going to be worth trying because we're going to learn something from it. You know, those are absolutely skills that if you learn them as a child or a teenager, you will take them forward and it will help you, because life is going to throw many curveballs your way. And so there will be many situations where you might feel anxious, many situations where you might feel upset, many situations where you might get angered. And if you have a strategy that allows you just to kind of almost balance yourself, to allow your thinking to be rational, it makes a huge difference. Mm. And so for sure, what you might learn, or what you as a parent, because the book is aimed at parents, but you know, what you as a parent might teach your son or daughter now is absolutely going to stand to them throughout their life.
Yeah, but by accident or design, and I presume it's the latter, you're actually working on yourself in working through this book to work with your children.
Yeah, well, I've certainly got a section. I've got a section in there about self-care for parents, because that old, you know, the adage of, or at least you hear it on the airplanes, you know, always look after your own oxygen supply before you deal with your child's, or your own life jacket before you deal with your child's life jacket, is very true. And so if you don't mind yourself, then it's very hard to mind your children. And I think that's always going to be relevant. So if, for sure, for parents, you know, you have to find ways to manage your own stresses. You have to even be aware of when you are stressed, because a little bit like I was saying earlier, if you're freaking out, if you're very distressed about something, that's going to have an impact on your son or daughter, you know, because the opposite of it is also true. You know, when we're calm, when we're relaxed, that co-regulation we can offer simply by our presence, by sounding relaxed and calm about it, by appearing it, you know, if you've got a young child, if you're cuddling them close and they feel that your heart rate is down and relaxed, that allows their heart rate to come down. So it's really important as parents that we do mind ourselves, or look for the social support to mind us, so that we can then mind our kids.
Yeah, and I think this is, you know, whatever we do to help our children, I think it has to be the right thing. And we have to look objectively at everything we are doing, teaching, saying, whatever it might be, to ensure that actually what we're doing right now at this time is the right thing for our children, and their future, and for us to offer them guidance and steering and help and direction. and not just a label or not just a catch-all or not just to do whatever you like because I'm afraid you might go into your bedroom and self-harm. You know, that we have to step up. And I'm not saying this is what you're thinking, David, but from what I can see, the way you've written that book, it speaks to that. And I like that. I like that, that it gives, you know, it maybe calls parents out slightly, but also empowers them to do what is actually best for their children and themselves, and not necessarily what's easiest.
Yeah, well, it's certainly not about what's easiest. I mean, it is definitely about trying to find, you know, what might help. I don't think the book really calls parents out. I don't think it overly challenges parents. It doesn't suggest that parents are getting it wrong.
Well, I'm going by your first comments where you said that we can be very quick to just label everything. That's the bit that I'm referencing, right? That we
can just, okay, yeah.
So not necessarily book, but the ethos or whatever it is. And that's why I said I wasn't speaking on your behalf. But we do, and that is often, ironically, what we see as the path of least resistance.
Well, even if, you know, even if a child has a diagnostic label that's, you know, that's relevant and appropriate for them, you still have to parent them. That's my experience of life. And so, you know, having an understanding of what it is that might ail your child doesn't, you know, give you kind of carte blanche to wash your hands of the situation as a parent, for sure. So I think, you know, irrespective of what it is that your child might be experiencing, your role as a parent is still to absolutely be present and be available and to try to help where you can. And so the other thing, though, I would say to parents is that, you know, we also have to accept we're only ever going to be good enough, and that's all we ever need to be for our kids. Like, we're never going to be perfect, we're never going to get everything fully right, and I think it's probably too much pressure on us to try to do that anyway. So we are as well off going, look, I'm doing my best. If my best isn't, you know, good enough, so be it. I can just try harder. I can do something different. And that really is what the book is about. It's about knowing that there are other things you can do.
And I know you've designed it to be compassionate and understanding, because, listen, there's no rule book as such. Well, maybe there's one now and it's called Fearless. I don't know. Fearless or Fearless. It's a 10-step guide to helping kids take charge of anxiety. It's by our guest, Dr. David Coleman. I'll let you go and have a cup of coffee. I can see coffee envy in your eyes after I was graced with one. Thank you. Best luck with it. And people can get it in all the usual places, I presume.
All the usual bookshops. It should be on the shelves already. Yeah.
Excellent. Okay, check it out. It's called Fearless. It's by Dr. David Coleman. Just a quick note before we leave. A number of sheep have gone missing from the Bluestack Mountains in Glenfinn area. They are presumed stolen. Can you please warn farmers to be wary of suspicious activity? Okay. We shall. Listen, have a great day, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to the programme, or if you chose to watch it. It's great to have you on board, whichever way. We're going to be back tomorrow morning to do it all again from 9 a.m.